Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. Well, four actually consolidated into three arguments. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. San Antonio Area Foundation versus Sylvan Stephen Lang and Jean Lang Matthews from Bexar County. The City of Harlingen versus the estate of David J. Charbonneau from Cameron County. And In re Terry Canales, consolidated with In re the County of Jim Wells, criminal mandamus proceeding. The court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners or relators may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and complete the arguments by lunch. These arguments are being taped by the court orally for our review, and you may purchase a copy of any tape for a nominal fee by making application with the clerk. We are ready to hear arguments from petitioners in San Antonio Area Foundation versus Lang and Matthews.
May it please the court, Mr. Hubert Green will present argument with the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes.
May it please the court, the San Antonio Area Foundation, the petition case, is a charitable foundation and is the residuary beneficiary under the will here in dispute.
Mr. Green, is it possible, I see your blow up here, is it possible to read this language in the disjunctive as the Court of Appeals found?
I don't think so.
And why not?
The reason is that the sequence, if you read the sequence of the language there, and I'm sure you're familiar with the language here, real property and oil and gas real properties in my state located in Frio County and Truro, San Antonio, Texas.
Yeah, if you put a comma after Texas, could it be read in the disjunctive?
Well, let me see. After Texas here?
The former.
First Texas.
Frio County, Texas.
Because the argument is that the devise of real property could refer only to the Frio County.
That's right. And I say it doesn't make any difference, and this is why. You divide the device into the three elements. The first element is the gift. What is the gift? The description of the gift. It is real property and oil and gas real properties in my state. That's the gift. Next, where is the location of the gift? The will uses the word located, which is perhaps the most essential word in paragraph 5. Frio County, Texas, and Crew Road in San Antonio, Texas. And, of course, the beneficiaries, the three elements of the device. Now, we contend that Crew Road is not a description of a gift. Testatrix did not give a city street in San Antonio to the beneficiary. No. This is a descriptive term of real property. Whether it's real property and oil and gas real properties, it doesn't matter. Because this is a description, and the description is real property, and as a matter of fundamental law, you cannot convey personal property by a device of real property. They are opposites in the law. And so when you look at it this way, when you separate the purposes of these words, describe the gift, give the location, and the beneficiaries, then it makes clear that Crew Road is not itself a gift. It is meaningless. It's further meaningless when you consider the fact that this is not a will written by a poor, uneducated lady in her own handwriting without knowledge of the niceties of these words. This is written by a Beverly Hills lawyer hired by her to write her will. and to convey her wishes. And so when the lawyer writes the word real property, he means real property. And when he writes the word through road, he does not mean to describe a gift of a city street. So taking those things into consideration, real property, through road, is the gift and the location of the gift. Now, did that answer the question? The property here in dispute is intangible personal property. Notes, promissory notes, contracts, profit contracts, and cash in the bank. That's what it is. The contention here by the Langs is that by this devise, and you look at, if you read the devise as a whole, of course, you can see this is the only paragraph in the will that devises real property. Paragraph 4 devises personal property in the form of cash gifts. 5th is the real estate device, specific device, admitted in the opinion, the court said, oh, we're not sure it's a specific device. Look at the pleadings of the Langs in the case. They describe it as a specific device, and that's particularly what it is. It is a specific device of real property. Paragraph 6 is the residuary clause. As a matter of fact, the bulk of all of the estate, California, Texas, wherever, goes to the foundation as the residuary beneficiary. So this is the only one that has to do with real property. Now, this personal property came into being on the sales of individual lots, sales of raw land to the developer. That's how they came into being, and that's why the doctrine of redemption is big in this case. It involves real property.
Mr. Green, the will is interpreted the way that you say it should be interpreted, then is it necessary for the doctrine of redemption to be applied in this case, or is that an alternative means of disposing of the case?
It's alternative. It is alternative.
So if we agree with your interpretation of the will, we would not reach the issue of redemption.
Well, as long as you deal with the word the real property, you don't agree with the interpretation.
If we agree.
That the common law and the cases and all of that say that you must go through to construe the will. If you lay that aside, you still have two doctrines. You have that provide legal presumptions. One is redemption, and the other is Probate Code Section 58C. Both are legal presumptions. They are telling us, as a matter of law, this is what happens in the case of land that is devised and has been sold and is no longer in existence, and it's been exchanged for consideration.
So in order for your client to win in this case, we would need to address the issue of redemption in connection with interpreting the will.
Well,
I just want to summarize what you just said in terms of the issues in the case.
Yes.
It's necessary to look at both the case law and Section 58 of the Probate Code, as well as the doctrine of redemption, to ascertain what is meant by real property.
They are alternate means of recovery. They are alternate means of recovery. They provide legal presumptions, you see. First, we go through the construction procedure of interpreting the language. That's one thing. Aside from that is the doctrine of redemption, which occurs when you devise real estate, sell it during the lifetime of the deceased, receive consideration, and the beneficiary of the real estate that's been sold comes and says, wait, I want the proceeds of the sale. And the doctrine of redemption, which is alive and well in Texas, under the Stahl case, says that no, you don't get the proceeds of the sale. The legal presumption as a matter of law is that the device is extinguished. And the consideration, in this case personal property, they could have exchanged another piece of land. Same group. You don't get the consideration received in the sale. The gift is extinguished. Now, The interesting thing about that.
Well, but the problem, Mr. Green, if we decide that something is something other than real property is conveyed under that fifth, then ademption wouldn't apply, because ademption goes with the assumption that real property was devised. But it was sold. In this case, we wouldn't reach your redemption argument until we determined real property was not what was devised.
I don't know that I agree with that. The actual fact of the matter, which are not in dispute, not before the court, not in controversy, is that Steve Lang has already received 90 acres of land that remains. We're fighting over the consideration received for previous land sales during the lifetime of the deceased. So he cannot extract the problem that he has with the property that he's going after. The property that he seeks, the personal property, is the consideration received for the lands that have been sold. Neither can there be any mystery about the identification, where it is, why it's part of that fruit road development. He has it, he holds it today. The land, the same land in that development that remained at F.
Well, let me be clear. Are you saying that the Langs are arguing that there's no dispute between the foundation and the Langs that this paragraph only devises real property, and the only issue is whether or not they're entitled to the proceeds from the sale?
They dispute that.
No, okay.
They make a different dispute in the Supreme Court for the very first time than they made before. But, of course, they do dispute. They disputed it first by saying, well, real property, we can come in and alter the meaning of real property by bringing in extrinsic evidence. That's really what for this.
And if they lose on that issue, then we don't reach the redemption. I mean, determined that was real
don't
property.
Don't have to. And then you have the probate code 58C argument that clearly, since 1993, the legislature said this is what a devise of real property means, and it means to exclude personal property unless you include it in the will. So you've got the legal presumption, which they just kind of put off on the side. Well, the point I was going to make under both ademption and 58C is intent is irrelevant. They say you can't. All right, suppose you've got 58C presumption. We can still bring in extrinsic evidence and struggle with the intent of the testator. No, you cannot. That's a rule of law. All of the ademption cases say that. Intent is irrelevant, so that means extrinsic evidence of intent is irrelevant, because it's like any legal presumptions. That's what it means.
Mr. Green, your opponent hangs their hat on Stewart versus Selder, a 1971 case out of this court, in which Stewart
right.
versus Selder, in which there is language that the court cited from Wigmore.
Yes.
That Chief Justice Calvert criticized in his
exactly.
concurring opinion. And they hang their hat on that to say that you can use extrinsic evidence to be able to interpret this will. Would it be necessary for us to overrule Stewart in order to rule your way? Or, if not, how do you reconcile Stewart with your position and the rest of Texas
very
law?
Very good question, and I have, I think, a very satisfactory answer to it. First place, Stewart has two paragraphs of dicta, two of them. And you have cases citing the first paragraph dealing with Wigmore as saying extrinsic evidence can come in to show the meaning and so forth, so circumstances surrounding. That is followed by a second paragraph that says, however, the intention of the testator must be found in the last analysis in the words of the will. The old strict law that we always know. And the interesting thing is you find cases citing the Stewart case on our side and citing, as they do in the Lang case, on their side, citing the two different paragraphs. Now, this very same court in two opinions since then, the Lehman case and the other, I forget, two Supreme Court cases have said, this is what Stewart means. And in both instances, it says, Stewart, you must have a ambiguity, or the words must lack meaning before you bring in extrinsic evidence to explain the words in the will. That's what Stewart means. one of the cases, the Supreme Court case, distinguished Stewart and said that's what it means. So you've got two later cases explaining what Stewart is, talking about first, if you had, as you did in Stewart, they decided you had this uncertainty of language, and they allowed consideration, they themselves considered the extrinsic evidence, and then as you point out, the Chief Justice, in a concurring opinion, criticized it. He quoted that very paragraph, the one that says about in the sense in which it used, following the Wigmore quote, and said you have no business writing that, because it isn't the law. The law is that you must have an ambiguity, and the Chief Justice gave an example in his concurring opinion. Suppose you leave separate property. Suppose you leave community property. Wait a minute. Somebody going to come in and alter the meaning of that? No. Those are words that have absolute certain legal meaning, and they would not allow the admission of extrinsic evidence. And so you have a case, I think, the Stewart case, that's very much misunderstood, very much misquoted. The two decisions of a few years later, this court explained their understanding of Stewart. And yet, it is true that you will find cases out there. Matter of fact, you find a commentator that says, Stewart, just open the door to extrinsic evidence. Forget the plain meaning rule any longer. You can bring in evidence to show intent, even in a will that is not ambiguous.
Mr.
Green, the Stewart case does not say that.
Can you help with something? There are notes involved here in this dispute. Are some of the notes secured by liens on real property?
Yes.
Are they secured by liens on real property at Prue Road?
Yes.
Is a lien on real property a real property interest?
No, it is not. And the cases, there are a long line of cases in this very situation saying that. They're cited. There's a code decision from out of state. There's an annotation that just goes on and on about all of the cases, like the Stahl case. In other words, where you sell a piece of property and you receive a note in exchange, that's personal property, the note. Secured or not. Mortgages, cases talking about mortgages, they're all personal property. So the courts have been through that argument many, many times. You don't get, as real estate, the consideration such as real estate lien notes. Absolutely not. So we say that.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Royal Lee will present argument from respondents.
May it please the court.
Mr. Lee, could I get you to get out of your brief, please?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Would you please get your brief?
I will.
Would you turn to page 12?
Yes, sir.
Footnote 10?
Yes, sir.
You say that there is no support in any controlling authority for a requirement of an ambiguity before a court may consider extrinsic evidence.
Have you read the Lehman case?
Lehman says if the will itself is unambiguous, the court should not go beyond the specific terms in search of that intent.
Indeed, Your Honor, because there are two kinds of extrinsic evidence that this court and other courts have identified in analyzing this issue, and I think this is the core of one of two issues essential for the court today. After Lehman, the latest word from this court on the question of consideration of extrinsic evidence is Kelly versus Martin, 714 Southwest 2nd, after Lehman, after Shriners Hospital. Again, in Kelly versus Martin, court says it's always appropriate to consider extrinsic evidence regardless of whether the will is ambiguous or not, because there are two kinds of extrinsic evidence that the court might consider. One of them is always permissible. The other, indeed, depends on whether or not there's an ambiguity. The first kind of extrinsic evidence that is always appropriate for the court to consider is historical evidence of the surrounding circumstances of the testator. And I think the best example of that comes from a case from the Austin Court of Appeals, factually very similar to this case, where the testatrix left to one of her beneficiaries, her Red River property. The trial court of appeals both allowed in extrinsic evidence from other people of how the testatrix, during her life, used this term, Red River property. Not what was the intent, not the direct issue of what did she intend in the will, but extrinsic evidence of what did this phrase mean in her life, in her surrounding circumstances.
Why isn't that an ambiguity, if there's some question about what she meant about the Red River property? I know you're trying to draw a line between two kinds of extrinsic evidence, but I don't understand why that is not an example. If there was some question about what the term Red River property meant in the will, why isn't that an ambiguity?
I think it may well be, Your Honor.
So then can you think of an example, then, of another kind of case that you talked about where there is not an ambiguity but extrinsic evidence can still be considered?
I think any time in a will, Your Honor, where the testator testatrix uses a popular or nickname for a bequest, there may be only one thing that it could be, but I think you're going to need extrinsic evidence. Even if there isn't two possible meanings for it, I think you're going to need extrinsic evidence to prove exactly what it is. Some of the courts call.
Think about what you said. Even if there's not two possible meanings to it, extrinsic evidence is going to be needed. In essence, if we go down the path you're trying to lead us, extrinsic evidence is going to be needed in about 99.9% of all will cases. And I don't think we need to be opening the door up to involving a dispute by people who are left alive concerning the words and the intent of a person who is dead.
Your Honor, I don't know if there are, if the percentage you suggest is correct.
Well, think about it. You're saying we got two different kinds of extrinsic evidence and we need to apply extrinsic evidence even if the term is unambiguous. If a term is unambiguous and we start involving going to extrinsic evidence under those circumstances, give me a type of will provision that we will not look to extrinsic evidence for, that we will not open it up for the whole litigation process.
Let me suggest...
Give me a term.
Give me a term. In Coker versus Coker, this court said the extrinsic evidence is proper if there is an ambiguity or if there is an uncertainty in the meaning. And I really think that's the best expression to use here.
What I'm saying, few things in law can be more clear than the term real property. If the term real property is subject to the application of extrinsic evidence, I can't think of a legal term that would not be subject to extrinsic evidence.
I'm inclined to agree with you there, Your Honor, but the question in this case is, are there one bequest or two? Is it a bequest of real property?
Well, let's focus on the first thing first. Give me an example of a legal term that would not be subject to the extrinsic evidence rule if, in fact, real property is subject to extrinsic evidence.
Your Honor, in Stewart versus Selder, the issue was the meaning of cash.
Okay, but Stewart has been grossly limited by Lehman and its progeny.
With all due respect, Your Honor, it was not limited in Kelly versus Martin. Again, in Kelly versus Martin, the court said the same thing that it said from Stewart versus Selder. Extrinsic evidence of the surrounding circumstances is always admissible regardless of whether or not there is the ambiguity or uncertainty.
Well, Mr. Lee, it seems to me what you're describing is a circumstance where the language in the will may appear to be clear, but when applied to the facts, it becomes less clear. The property at Red River. I give my property at Red River. And when you go down there, you find out it's a house, it's got all these furnishings, it's got everything in it. And so the extrinsic evidence demonstrates that we've got both real and personal, but the will doesn't say which one. And so even though the will is perfectly clear, that once you apply it to the existing facts, it becomes uncertain and you get the extrinsic evidence. It seems to me that's what those cases all try to get at, where the language appears to be clear, but when you put it down on the property, it's not clear what it is that testatrix or testator wanted to do. I think the difficulty here is she says she's giving the real property, and the argument you're trying to make is I devise and bequeath Prue Road. is what you're trying to argue. You're trying to argue that I devised Prue Road, and because we don't know if it's the real property or the personal property of Prue Road, we have to go extrinsic evidence to get what she really meant. And Prue Road really meant all of her transaction, not just part of it. But it seems to me you're stuck with Mr. Green's argument that the gift is real property. Prue Road just shows up in the location.
May I get my aid? Your Honor, because I'd like to focus the court on this issue. The words simply are not that clear.
I have a question. The CA's opinion said it was not clear from the record whether the property in Frio County was just an oil and gas interest or whether there were other real property interests. What is the answer to that question?
Your Honor, I don't know. I've not been involved in the administration or the actual probate proceeding, and I can't answer that. I simply don't know. I can tell you this, though.
Would that, even under your theory of the case, wouldn't that be crucial to determining whether there's an ambiguity? Because if the only interest in Frio County was royalty interest, for example, there is no real property in Frio County.
I don't believe that's necessarily the case, because you begin here with the actual words of the will. When you get right here, in the second line, you're stuck with something that is simply unclear.
Well, let me ask you, this argument, I believe you've raised that for the first time here. Below, you yourself admitted that the real property term was a predicate to Prue Road. Is that right? I mean, it was only the Court of Appeals that came up with that argument on its own for the first time, and then you took off with that in this court, correct?
That was the way we presented the argument in the Court of Appeals. I think our pleadings in the trial court were broader and covered the idea.
Well, that's a different question, whether it could have covered back into the pleadings. I mean, this was an argument that you didn't make until the Court of Appeals came up with it, correct?
Well, I didn't present it in the Court of Appeals in the way that the Court of Appeals analyzed it, but it's perfectly appropriate for the Court of Appeals or this court to make rulings on that issue.
I understand that, and I'm not arguing about that with you, but I believe, as I recall your briefing in the Court of Appeals, you yourself used the term real property to define Prue Road. Is that correct?
I think what we called it was the Prue Road property. I think that's the way we characterized, that's the way we suggested, the meaning that we suggested, the Prue Road property. When you get right here, the words are simply unclear, because she says located in Frio County, Texas, and Prue Road. She didn't put any sort of modifier before Prue Road. What did she mean? Did she mean in Prue Road? Obviously, she didn't mean in Prue Road. And so both sides at that point begin editing and characterizing, interpreting the will. The foundation suggests that what she really meant was real property along or near Prue Road. But to suggest that is to edit, is to speculate.
That's not what I heard Mr. Green saying, though. Mr. Green looked at the language, the actual language, and broke it down into the language of the devise, the location of it, and the beneficiary, which would be the elements of the devise. How do you respond to his argument that those are the actual elements of the paragraph?
My response, Your Honor, is that's simply his interpretation. But if we begin with the words, the interpretation I propose, Your Honor, suggests is just
it says, I devise and bequeath the real property and oil and gas real properties in my estate. And you want to limit that to then Frio County.
Yes, Your Honor.
The rest of the will, I think it was the paragraph fourth that came before, dealt with all the devises of personal property.
Correct.
This looks like the paragraph that devises real property. That's another one of his arguments. How do you respond that when we look at the words of the will in its entirety, there's only one interpretation that can be given to the will, and this is the paragraph that devises real property?
I just disagree with that, Your Honor, because when you get to these words, you get stuck when you get to Prue Road.
No, sir, I'm asking you how you reconcile his argument that this paragraph deals with real property and the fourth paragraph of the will devises personal property. That's the way the will is structured. How do you respond to that without looking at the internal language of this paragraph?
That is speculation, Your Honor. It's a proposal for an interpretation.
But it's nothing more than that. You simply must edit the words to make them make sense one way or the other. Because she didn't leave Crewe Road unless it means something more than a street. She obviously didn't leave real property in Crewe Road. And so...
Why not?
Because if she did...
Maybe that's just an awkward use of a preposition.
What it is, I suggest, Your Honor, is unclear. And...
Grammatically, in order to separate Crewe Road the way you want to separate it, there should be a comma after Frio County, comma, Texas, comma, in order to separate it. Isn't that correct grammatically?
I don't think a comma is necessary there to separate it grammatically, Your Honor. I won't tell you that I know rules
using,
of
applying rules of grammatical construction to the interpretation of contracts. Because there is no comma, and because of the word and, doesn't Crewe Road necessarily refer back to the real property of oil and gas properties?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because if it did...
I'm talking about you applying only rules of contract construction and grammatical construction.
And I don't think it does, Your Honor, because if it did, it would mean in Crewe Road. And I don't think that's what it meant. I think there's something missing there, or there must be a separation there. I think to look at the words of the will, those are the only two possibilities. Either there's something missing, or there's a separation. Because the only third possibility is that it means in Crewe Road. And that, Your Honor, nobody contends that. Nobody suggests that's a reasonable interpretation.
Mr. Lee, one of your main points in your brief that you take from the Court of Appeals opinion is the proposition that if any evidence supports a reasonable construction of a will, other than that urged in a summary judgment motion based on the words of the will, the trial court must recognize evidence supporting the construction opposing the motion, deny the motion. And that seems to me to be the fundamental premise underlying your argument. What authority do you have that for that proposition, that if the summary judgment motion is based on the words of the will, that you can then invites extrinsic evidence and a summary judgment motion must be denied? You cite no authority in your brief for that. Do you have any?
This court's decision in Stewart versus Selder, where the court said, the will said cash, and the court said, we will look to the record and extrinsic evidence because it could possibly mean two different things. And so the court said, we'll search the record evidence. If we find record evidence that supports a broader meaning of cash, that is, securities, deposit accounts, if we find support in the record the form of circumstantial, surrounding circumstances, then we'll consider that and we won't go to the ordinary common meaning of the word cash.
But that is because the court determined there was an ambiguity in the will with respect to the use of the word cash. And aren't you inviting us to find an ambiguity in the use of the word real property in this case in order to make it fit underneath the Stewart framework?
Not in the words real property. Either,
why not?
Either in the words Crewe Road or in the phrase that has something missing in it, that either says real property in Crewe Road, which is nonsensical, or requires some interpretation beyond the words, requires the possibility.
Let's assume that it requires some interpretation. One interpretation would be that this is simply a common drafting problem. This is simply a problem that any of the judges up here encounter when there are two descriptions, Frio County and Crewe Road, and they're all subject to the introductory phrase, I devise and bequeath the real property, and you're just trying to figure out how to save words, but in county, property can be in a county, but it can only be on a road. And so you just as you're drafting the phrase, I devise and bequeath the real property and one gas properties in my estate located in Frio County and Prue Road, and you just forget. I mean, you just try to send them, wait a minute, that doesn't quite fit because the in isn't the right prepositional word for Prue Road. I mean, that's a very common drafting error, and so they just make some mistake. Is that a more reasonable explanation for interpreting that paragraph than one that says, well, because the on is not there, common draft, because that's not there, what they really did is convey two gifts, not real property. They conveyed a real property in Frio County, and they conveyed all property on Prue Road. Is that as reasonable an understanding of how this came into being?
Your Honor, I can't tell you if it's more reasonable, because that's what a jury is for. The question for the court is, are they both at least reasonable? If they are both reasonable interpretations, then it's for a jury to decide. And I suggest to you that they are both reasonable interpretations. Which is more reasonable? Well, I think mine is, particularly when you look at the correspondence among the Lang family members, where the letters begin, Ray, Prue Road, and go on to talk about the land and the development of the land and the proceeds from sale of lots and development of the land.
Mr. Lee, taking you back to originally when you were talking about the fact that there were two rules regarding extrinsic evidence. One is that it's always permissible historical evidence of surrounding
circumstances.
And the second, I take it, is in connection with an ambiguity?
Indeed, Your Honor. When there
Which
is,
rule are you applying in this case?
I think you need only the surrounding circumstances evidence.
So then there is not an ambiguity in this particular will.
I think there is, Your Honor, but I don't think you need to find that to consider the surrounding circumstances.
But the issue that's presented in this case is asking us to review what the Court of Appeals said and did with respect to consideration of extrinsic evidence. So it's very important for us to understand what your position is on what you think Texas law is on extrinsic evidence and how it should be applied here. So you're asking us to say that it's always permissible and that when historical evidence of surrounding circumstances needs to be considered and that this is one of those cases and this is not a case where we should look to the law on ambiguity.
I'm saying you should because I think there is an ambiguity. I don't think you need to reach that to affirm the Court of Appeals. I think you could stop at the historical evidence submitted in an appendix to our brief. I think you could look at that, and I think that's enough. Beyond that, I think it is ambiguous, and I think if you considered the other evidence in the record, the direct evidence of Ms. Lang's intent.
I would like to go back to your first rule then, since that's the one you want us to apply, because I still do not understand how that rule is applied. Any of the examples I've heard you give in response to questions seem to be based upon an ambiguity. Give us an example of the kind of always permissible situation that you're talking about where there is not an ambiguity at issue.
If by ambiguity, Your Honor, you mean either two meanings or unclear, then I agree with you. If by ambiguity you mean only subject to two meanings, then I would add to that the possibility of any situation that's unclear.
Okay, you've completely lost me.
Okay.
For you to do that again.
Okay. I think if you look outside the law, if you looked at a Webster's dictionary, ambiguity means subject to two or more meanings. And in law, I think we use ambiguity to mean either that possibility or simply unclear, of doubtful meaning, not clear from the words. If when you use ambiguity, Your Honor, you mean both of those possibilities, then I agree with you. If you mean only...
You agree with me, and what is your conclusion?
I agree with you that any time there is either something that is subject to two meanings or unclear, then consideration of the extrinsic evidence is always proper.
And then that means that there really are not two different types then. If we attach that meaning...
If you attach that meaning, then I think that's correct, Trump. Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kenzie. Thank you.
It is, I think, undoubtedly true that if this judgment is affirmed, and the lower courts tend to follow the language of the Court of Appeals, that any disappointed beneficiary can simply go out and dredge up some witnesses and sign up some affidavits and say, this is what Aunt Susie, I heard her say one time.
Well, that's not necessarily true if you read it in the disjunctive.
That what?
If you read this phrase in the disjunctive, that's not necessarily true. In other words, we could find that real property is unambiguous and you can't use extrinsic evidence to determine what that means.
Yes.
But if we, as the Court of Appeals did, read it in the disjunctive, we don't open the floodgates, as you suggest.
Well, I don't know that I agree with that. I think the idea of this kind of language and arguing over this kind of language will tend to open it up to jury trials, the meeting of wills, and I thought many times, what would the jury be charged with in this case? The jury going to be told what Section 58C says? Is it going to be charged in redemption? Is it going to be just say, now what's the, you give whatever weight you want to the laws as to the presumptions of meeting and then weigh that against whatever? There'd be no way to govern that. Let me answer the Justice O'Neill's questions about the pleadings in this case. Counsel for the Langs have described this gift in so many different ways throughout all of the pleadings and papers in this case. Perhaps it's forgotten. In his trial pleading in the probate court, it is said, well, the assets may be described as Prue Road property, Prue Road real property, including not only the raw land, but the notes and the net profit agreements, accounts, and all derivations thereof. Listen to this. This is what Ruth Lang meant by the words, quote, Prue Road real property in San Antonio, Texas, in the will. They take that and turn it around and precede that clause with Prue Road and call it Prue Road real property in San Antonio, Texas, in her will. That is what everybody called it. So if you look at Lang's affidavit, and all, you know, they're just all over the board about what they're saying. Here in the pleading, the amended pleading filed by leave of court after the hearing, this is what everybody called it. All the Prue Road real property assets. And so the lawyer is telling the court this, and the same identical language is found in the response to summary judgment, telling the court, this is what we're going to call it. It's Prue Road real property, what we're calling this device. Just uniting those terms, except putting Prue Road first for some reason, so that's what they've got. That's what they're stuck with. That's what they say. And then the said in the answer, that's what it meant. That's what the will meant. Prue Road real property in San Antonio, Texas. That's page 4. Then, of course, we complained that they had not even pled ambiguity, so the court granted leave to do so. So this is a pleading of ambiguity. Thus, the phrases Prue Road real property and in San Antonio, Texas. See, got them out of order. Starts off. Thus, the phrases Prue Road, real property, and in San Antonio, Texas, are ambiguous because they're subject to two reasonable meanings.
But that's the court's not precluded from finding on its own, as the Court of Appeals here did, that there's an ambiguity.
Yeah.
No.
Did not do
so. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
All right.